the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America, and welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting today live from Nashville, Tennessee. We appreciate the folks here at For Faith and Family, their hospitality. We are here in Nashville, and of course, there's lots to talk about. And our main topic today comes from Time Magazine. Every once in a while, you see a cover story in one of the nation's leading news magazines that just catches your attention because you know it is onto something big. In this case, we're not talking about some kind of scientific or medical discovery. We're talking about a very important phenomenon that has to do with most American families. Time's cover story this week is entitled this, What Teachers Hate About Parents. Incredible picture on the front, a harried teacher surrounded by a mother and two dads, one pushing a cell phone, another pushing a picture of his assuredly innocent kid. The mom's holding an obviously unacceptable report card. But rather than challenging the kid to do better, obviously this mom, the picture says it all, is coming to take out her fury on the teacher. On the cover of Time magazine this week, here is the subtitle. It says, Pushy dads, hovering moms, parents who don't show up at all, are kids paying the price? Now, I imagine that right now out there across America listening to this program are some school teachers who are thankful the week is over. No doubt you love your job, you love the task of teaching, you love the kids, but you're glad the week is over. Today is your opportunity to do one more act of nobility as a teacher, and that is to call us and tell us what you as teachers are really facing in the classroom. I'd love to hear from parents, too, but I want to say right up front this afternoon as we're talking about this program and we're talking about Time's cover story this week, I especially would love to hear from some teachers with firsthand experience about what it means to confront parents who think that the teacher is the problem and think their kid just can't do anything wrong and think that whatever their kid fails to do in academic performance is someone else's fault. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. No doubt the teacher has a tough job, but one of the toughest jobs in America has just gone to Ambassador John Negroponte. He is President Bush's choice to be the new director of intelligence for the entire government, if approved by the Senate, as is expected. Mr. Negroponte, who at present is the United States ambassador to Iraq, will go from one hot seat to another, where his new task will be to coordinate a network of 15 different intelligence agencies serving the federal government. That's right, 15. And the reality is, they do not talk to each other very much. And so we have been having 15 different agencies doing their own things, not sharing information, while Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations are increasingly consolidating and centralizing their own information and strategy structure. So it's high time. This was President Bush's pick for the job, and it was the job President Bush proposed to Congress. And it looks like Ambassador Negroponte will have bipartisan support, and he's going to need it because he's going to have to not only bring a daily intelligence report to the President of the United States, regularly he is going to be in front of Congress discussing the issues of report and of urgency that he will have to account for in terms of 15 different agencies. You can pretty much expect that this is one nominee who's going to get a very swift confirmation from the Senate, and then he will assume as the first incumbent in this job one of the nation's most challenging responsibilities. Speaking of new leaders, the Democratic National Committee has a new leader, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, and we've talked about this quite a bit. And I have a major analysis of Mr. Dean and what this means for the Democratic Party on my website at albertmohler.com. Also, my published commentary for today at crosswalk.com. My interest in this is not really partisan. It is cultural. It's moral. It's what it has to do as a strategic sign of what's going on in the country. The election of Howard Dean as chairman of any party, much less the Democratic Party, under these terms, under these conditions, at this time, says a great deal both about that party and about the state of the nation and our political discourse and the future of what we're going to be facing in choices made between Democratic and Republican positions on any number of issues. But my particular urgency in addressing Mr. Dean and his meaning for the Democratic Party comes down to the fact that we have here an insidious attempt, I believe, on the national media's part to try to present Mr. Dean as a moderate. Yesterday, I mentioned Paul Krugman of the New York Times that described the election of Howard Dean as the ascendancy of the, quote, fighting moderates, end quote, in the Democratic Party. USA Today, in an unsigned editorial, tried to say the same thing. And this is being repeated ad infinitum, ad nauseum, all over America. And I just want to set the record straight. I'm indebted to George Neumeyer of the American Spectator that makes very clear that, just to take one issue, the issue of abortion, Governor Dean is on the far, far left wing. There's nothing centrist about this at all. He is one of the most pro-abortion leaders in American history. As governor of Vermont, he pushed the idea of $5 copays for abortions. Under his administration, Vermont had 359 abortions for every 1,000 live births. We're talking about a man who did a rotation as an OBGYN for Planned Parenthood. We're talking about a man who has won Planned Parenthood's Margaret Sanger Award. They don't give that away to centrists on the issue of abortion. We have here an effort at lying by repackaging Howard Dean. Now, I have to tell you, I don't think it's going to work, even without reporters like George Neumeyer and programs like this shining light upon his real convictions, because I think he's going to have to let it out. Remember, this is Mr. I Have a Scream speech. I don't think he's going to be able to hold in his inner convictions. And the Democratic Party is going to have a hard time dealing with his record. As a matter of fact, the Democratic Party is going to have a hard time dealing with his new book. It's still out on the new bookshelf of several bookstores. It's entitled You Have the Power, but of course now in terms of the Democratic Party, Mr. Dean has the power. In this book, he speaks of his support for and signing of a bill in Vermont that put that nation right on the front lines of the same-sex marriage union issue. In 1999, that state Supreme Court ruled that the laws were unconstitutional, suggesting that gays could not marry. So Governor Dean, rather than try to challenge that in the courts to take it further, instead decided he was going to lead the movement for same-sex unions, these kind of covenantal unions that they came up with in Vermont. Listen to this out of his most recent book. This isn't written years ago. This is just weeks ago. He says, I was invited to many, many gay groups and got to know a lot of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered Americans. Well, I realized that there wasn't anything different about gay people except they fell in love with people the same sex. So in other words, he just learned not to take homosexuality seriously when it comes to marriage. He says this, bragging, he says, we created a parallel institution to marriage with a different name because marriage was entwined with many people's religious beliefs. Our compromise gave gay and lesbian couples in our state all the same rights that heterosexuals had, except for those rights accorded by the federal government, which were outside of our purview, and that needs to be fixed as well. So there's no doubt about where he is on this. But what's interesting is the larger worldview rationale that he gives here. On page 115 of his new book, he says this, it is impossible to love America and hate Americans of any kind. Okay, just put a period there for a moment. What he's saying here is that any moral opposition to same-sex marriage is rooted in hatred. Now, if you get to set the debate this way, you might as well be Joseph Goebbels in Nazi Germany and just go ahead and be the minister of propaganda. Because this is unvarnished propaganda in its most uncompromising way. It's just presented here as hatred. He goes on to say prejudice, bigotry, racism, these aren't the kinds of problems that will fix themselves or fade away under the weight of good intentions, but they can be fixed if people can be made to see their common humanity. Now listen to this next sentence. If each American can be led to figure out his or her personal biases and watch out for them, because we all have them, every single one of us, and overcoming them is something we have to work on every day, every single moment when you interact with other people, end quote. Oh, good grief. What he's suggesting here is that any strong moral conviction is just a bias you have to overcome. You see, strong moral conviction, now we're not arguing either at this point as to whether these convictions are right or wrong, because obviously holding the wrong moral convictions is just dead wrong. But if you're holding the right moral convictions, it doesn't matter to Howard Dean. If you take the logic of the sentence, he says, you need to get over it. You need to name your bias for what it is and then learn to overcome it. Well, obviously, this is a one-way argument, because you're not finding Howard Dean suggesting that the Democrats and his convictions, his pro-abortion convictions, represent a bias he needs to overcome. This is a one-way argument, but I have to give him an E for effort here. This is very clever packaging. The Democrats may think that the election of Howard Dean as the chairman of their party means that they're going to find a way out, but if so, it's not going to be a way out through the center door, I can assure you of that. The Democrats do have a tradition they could reclaim. Just a few days ago, I was handed this quote from another former Democratic presidential candidate. Listen to this. Quote, wanted or unwanted, I believe that human life, even at its earliest stages, has certain rights which must be recognized. The right to be born, the right to love, the right to grow old. When history looks back to this era, it should recognize this generation as one which cared about human beings enough to halt the practice of war, to provide a decent living for every family, and to fulfill its responsibility to its children from the very moment of conception. End quote. Did you hear that? Its responsibility to its children from the very moment of conception. Those words spoken by Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. Teddy Kennedy, who in 1976 ran for the Democratic presidential nomination. Those words were said in 1971, 2 years before Roe v. Wade. And as we might say, and lamentably often have to say, that was then, and this is now. Well, Ted Kennedy was right then, he's wrong now, and that's the only way out for the Democratic Party. And it would be a great thing to have two parties that are pro-life, both speaking for life. Then we'd face a real choice. We'll be back to talk about the war on teachers by parents. From Nashville, Tennessee, I'm Albert Mohler. Program. We know that teaching is a tough job. As a matter of fact, teachers in many ways are on the front lines of the culture war and many other significant battles as well. Time Magazine's current cover story is just fascinating because it presents a story of pushy parents, hovering parents, parents who are public defenders, parents who come in to seek the discipline of the teacher rather than to support the discipline of the child. You have parents who think their kid can do no wrong. Time Magazine really lays it out. The reporter, Nancy Gibbs, does a great job. Listen to this. An Iowa high school counselor gets a call from a parent protesting the C her child received on an assignment. The parent argued every point in the essay, recalls the counselor, who soon realized why the mother was so upset about the grade. It was apparent that she had written it. A sixth grade teacher in California tells a girl in her class that she needs to work on her reading at home, not just in school. Her mom came in the next day and started yelling at me that I had emotionally upset her child. This is the reporter's statement here. When our children are born, we study their every eyelash and marvel at the perfection of their toes, and in no time become experts in all they do. But then the day comes when we are expected to hand them over to a stranger standing at the head of a room full of bright colors and small chairs. Well aware of the difference a great teacher can make and the damage a bad teacher can do, parents turn over their kids in hope. Please handle with care. Please don't let my children get lost. They're breakable and precious. But oh, push them hard and don't let up and make sure they get into Harvard. I think that's about it. This particular article demonstrates different phenomena. The hovering parent, in fact, one administrator here in schools refers to some parents as helicopter parents. They simply won't go away. They just hover over their kids. One headmaster of an elite academy speaks of, and this is a boys' school, speaks of moms who show up at lunch just to watch their kids eat. Teenage boys eat like they couldn't do that without mom. And obviously, as this indicates, some of these boys are quite embarrassed to have their moms hovering over them like a helicopter, telling, I guess, 16-year-old Johnny to eat his carrots. They're probably hyponic, no doubt, right from the health food store. I'd love to hear from some teachers, because something tells me that Time Magazine is onto something. I think this is a pinpoint, a spotlight, on a cultural phenomenon that tells us a great deal about more than the classroom experience. I think it tells us about the change in how parents think of their own children, the shift in authority that robs teachers of a lot of the authority that is necessary for teaching. I think it explains a lot of the misbehavior in schools when Johnny is disciplined and the parent takes up for Johnny rather than following this up with the kind of discipline that should back up the teacher's instructions. I think we're in a mess. And I'd love to hear what you think about it. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Toll-free nationwide, 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Marie calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA, a third-grade teacher, a veteran. I bet she's got something to tell us. Marie, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I love teaching kids. And, you know, the paperwork is not that bad. But a few parents that can give you such a hard time can really make the day long.
Well, Marie, something tells me that you got a story you could tell us here.
Oh, I've got quite a few. I won't do specifics, but I will just say that you can have a child lie right to your face and call the parents that evening and tell them, and the parents will, you know, tell you things like, well, we've never, ever seen our child ever lie before. I don't know where that behavior would have ever come from.
So you're lying about their child lying.
Supposedly, I guess if someone's lying and they're going to have to point the finger at someone, I guess it would be the teacher. Now, don't get me wrong. I have some parents that are wonderful, and it is a blessing to partner with them in educating their child, but you get one or two, and it can make the year, it makes May look like it's long in coming.
Well, Marie, I tell you, I appreciate your honesty, and there's a real sweetness. I can tell why you're in the classroom, and I know you must be a great teacher just because you love the teaching and you love the kids, and you have a wonderful attitude about this. But, Marie, you're a third-grade teacher. I want to test something out with you here. I hear increasingly from parents who, especially when it comes to at-home projects and everything, are taking it over. I heard from a parent in Colorado who told me just a few weeks ago that, you know, he's tired of showing up and finding out that his kid's science project got graded down because it isn't as good as the other one that some other's dad did. Do you see a lot of that?
Yes. I used to give away prizes for the best spaceship or the best log cabin, and I realized very quickly that I could not do that. I had to give all the children prizes and find something special about all of them, because there were some that you had a hard time telling if that was my little 8-year-old or if that was their father and mother, which you want the parents' help. You want that. You want mom and dad to sit with them and help them, but not do it for them. And that's very hard to be able to grade something like that. So you either just say this is a fun project or everybody's going to get an E for effort, you know?
Yeah.
So,
Marie, I have to tell you, I read another article about a kindergarten teacher that had a science day, and one of the kids showed up with a model rocket that flew up into the air and had a parachute and was landed and everything, and the dad stood there operating it, insisting that the little boy come up with the idea all by himself and had done it all alone in his bedroom. Somehow, I just don't think they bought it. Marie, thank you so much for calling. We want to go to a teacher who shall remain nameless. We're going to call her Betty, calling from Cleveland, listening on WHK. Betty, you go right ahead.
Hi.
You got the microphone. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to just represent the flip side of the spectrum on this, because I don't get parent involvement at all. I may have one to two parents, period, that want to come up and show that they're involved in their son or daughter's education. And it's really discouraging to me, because I feel like I'm the only one that's doing the motivating for them to do projects and so forth. And I was listening to the other caller saying that she's gotten certain projects turned in, and maybe the parents have done it. I don't have parents at home motivating the kids to even do a project, or they'll say that they didn't even hear about it.
Well, that is a flip side. That's an important thing we need to hear. And, you know, quite frankly, I think in some schools, that's probably what you're describing is probably a much bigger problem than what Time Magazine's onto here. And so you remind us that there really is a parental responsibility to get in there. And I appreciate the fact that you understand and affirm the fact that parents really do need to be involved. I think the hard thing for us all is knowing how involved to be. Because when Time starts talking about these hovering parents and helicopter parents, I'm pretty sure that nails a lot of us who would be tempted, especially when our kids are in the younger grades, to just be involved in everything. And some kids need more than others. I think that's another thing we need to admit. But I have to say, as an educator, the big issue for me is the authority of the teacher, because we expect teachers to do a phenomenal job. We expect them to do a huge job, to assume an almost incalculable responsibility. And that can't be done if their authority and responsibility and place in the classroom is continually being undermined. We've got callers from Ohio and around the country. It is time for you to join this conversation as well. Call us toll-free nationwide, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. This is from Time Magazine, the cover story. Long gone are the days when the school was a fortress, opened a couple of times a year for parents' night and graduation, but generally off-limits to parents unless their kids get into trouble. Now you can't walk into halls of schools, public or private, without tripping over parents in the halls. They volunteer as library aides and reading coaches and mentor moms. Supplement the physical education offerings with yoga and kickboxing. Sponsor faculty appreciation lunches and fundraising barbecues, supervise field trips and road games and father-daughter service projects. Some of these parents are so involved and are there so often that in some schools they have demanded their own parking places. Something weird's going on here. I think this tells us a lot about parental expectation and also about a different way we look at children, and beyond that, at childhood. Do we let our children learn? Sometimes they have to learn by failing. And you know what? Sometimes they have to be told the bad news that they didn't do well, and they're going to have to work harder and do better. Say that in some schools, and you may face an attorney. Phone number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK from Nashville, Tennessee. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Well, some of you will remember the old song, Reading and Writing and Arithmetic, talk to the tune of the Hickory Stick. Back when I went to school, they still used the P-A-D-D-L-E, paddle. And some folks used it fairly often. And my dad had a little talk with me before I went to the first grade. I'll never forget it. He sat me down, and here's how it went. And all over America, at least in my generation, boys and girls, probably boys especially, got the same speech. You ever get paddled at home, at school? Just wait till you get home. You get in trouble at school? Just wait till you get home. Because if you think you got into trouble at school, that's just a down payment on the trouble you're going to face at home. I think that's a whole world ago. Because at least what I hear from teachers is, if they give Johnny a little demerit for misbehavior, Johnny's parent will show up to be his advocate. And if there is even sterner discipline that is required, detention, extra work, even suspension, anything just really, really serious like that, some parents are literally showing up with attorneys. I think the world was a safer place when teachers had moral authority and parents did not attempt to subvert that authority. Now, we're talking in generalizations here, and this conversation is prompted by this cover story in Time magazine. Let me say right up front, I know there are a lot of wonderful, mature, faithful, responsible parents out there. God bless you. You're not our concern. God bless you. Go forth and populate the earth with other responsible parents. We're talking today about the specific pattern of parents in a big trend across America who are subverting teachers and subverting classroom authority. Let's go to Anita, calling from Louisville, Kentucky on WFIA. Anita, go right ahead.
Dr. Mohler, glad to talk with you. I just wanted to relate a story. I am a retired teacher, and so I know from experience how parents are. But I remember how my parents taught me authority for teachers, or taught me respect for the authority of teachers. And it was very similar to what you just mentioned, that if I was receiving a discipline at school, I could expect a double dose of it at home. Plus the fact, when I was in the eighth grade, I learned another very big lesson. It was Sunday night. I had a project due, and it was in church, and I was very panicked about how I was going to get it done for the next morning, so my father drew it all out for me, and I took it to school, and I received an A, and it was up on the board. Well, a short time later, when my father saw the teacher, he said, "Say, I see I got an A on that project I did," and that kind of cured me of asking him to help me after that.
Ouch, Anita, that hurts. That hurts to hear right now. But, you know, I think that's a great lesson. I mentioned this parent in Colorado who mentioned, you know, you go to these science fairs and, you know, you've got seventh graders showing the entire, you know, workings of an atomic bomb, you know, with a little working model sitting beside on the desk. I did this at home. You know, we had these spare parts around in the garage. Meanwhile, beaming father in the background, who happens to be an engineer at NASA, just overlooking this like he accidentally happened to have this offspring. And it's not just dads, it's moms, too. And different dads and moms have different interests, and that gets pushed into this. But, you know, I think one of the problems is that our ego gets associated with our children. And I say that as a parent because I know just how easy it is. Our ego can be, and sometimes it's literally, like Anita was talking here and like this Time magazine cover story, there are times we get so involved in our children's schoolwork we feel like we got a grade. You know, we, parent and child. Something's gone over the edge there. Something's gone over the line. And let's face it, Harvard University right now has 18,000 students, graduate and undergraduate. They received 22,000 applications this year for about 3,500 openings. Not everyone's going to get into Harvard. Not even 1% of 1% of 1% will get into Harvard. But every parent thinks, especially looking to the crib, that this is a kid who's Harvard bound. This is a kid who's going to win the Nobel Prize and also find the cure for cancer and the common cold on the way to becoming a world-class architect and artist. We all have those hopes. The problem is, if we do not believe that our children should really be held accountable in the classroom, and we don't believe that the teacher ought to have the authority to teach, and we don't believe that they sometimes have to learn by making mistakes and getting, yes, sometimes substandard, some expectational grades, then we're going to delude our children, we're going to delude ourselves, we're going to frustrate teachers. And frankly, we could very well end up with uneducated children who got good grades because their parents did the work. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Time Magazine's talking about it, and so should we. I'm here in Nashville, Tennessee, broadcasting today all across the nation. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Have to learn how to give report cards, grade papers, mark tests. I'm not kidding you folks when I tell you that there was a serious article in the Chronicle of Higher Education in recent months suggesting that teachers need to stop using red marking pens to mark people down, to mark papers, to make comments, because it hurts self-esteem. Red, according to these psychologists, is associated with anger. And thus it looks like the teacher's angry. And that hurts the student's self-esteem. So instead, this article proposed that you use the color purple. Because purple, according to these psychologists, is the color of acceptance. Use the non-threatening color purple ink in order to mark papers and make comments. Even where you must mark down, according to these instructions, you should do so in the most positive way. Now, how do you do that? Okay, little Betty. That's a very creative way to spell cat, but the rest of us are going to spell it a different way. You know, we're talking about nonsense here. All this self-esteem language and all the rest. And I think it is a huge change in worldview, a huge change in the way we understand children. Because rather than seeing children as little human beings who must necessarily be taught and disciplined, you have this humanistic worldview that sees children as autonomous little individuals from whom good things must simply be drawn out. All that good stuff's in there. You just have to draw it out. The teacher's responsibility is to draw it out as painlessly as possible. We're going to go to Mark calling from Houston, Texas, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Mark, you got the mic.
Dr. Mueller, interesting you're talking about self-esteem. This problem is not only prevalent in the schools, it's also prevalent in the churches. I'm a Sunday school teacher, or I was a Sunday school teacher, and I had the sad responsibility of disciplining a group of teenagers. Unfortunately, I was disciplined because I dared harm their self-esteem because I corrected them about their actions in church.
Well, Mark, what kind of radical are you anyway?
I know. To expect them to listen to the pastor when he preaches and to not grope the girl next to them is something that I shouldn't expect out of the teenagers. The interesting thing, too, is when I did this, there was a young lady that was the center of attention in the pew, and when I addressed them and talked to them about it, the mother of the daughter called me, and she wasn't upset for the fact that I had disciplined her daughter. She was upset that I had hurt the self-esteem of her boyfriend.
Well, Mark, there you go again. Something tells me you're a serial offender and along these lines. But, you know, this just points to the insanity of all this. You know, where are the parents who say, look, you got caught doing this in school. You have no idea how much trouble you're in. That teacher is there to watch, to monitor, to have authority, to discipline where necessary, and I'm going to support that teacher to the utmost. Now, if the teacher does what is demonstrably wrong, that's got to be dealt with in a different way. But what we're talking about here is the routine subversion. For Mark, it was in church, of all places, where Christian parents should know better. I'll say more about that in just a moment, but it's happening in the schools, too. Wherever the teacher stands to teach, especially in the schools, as we're focusing today, this is a big issue. We're going to go to Rhonda, calling from Kingman, Arizona. Rhonda, go right ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Rhonda. Glad to hear from you there out in the far west. Go right ahead.
My comment is that I am from a divorce. I am divorced from my children's father. They stay with him. And I have gone to their schools and have told them specifically that if they have any problems with my children whatsoever, please call me. Don't hesitate. I've given them my cell phone, my home phone, everything. And I am looked at like I am an outcast because they don't particularly want to know what I have to say about my children's education. A lot of them, teachers out there, I feel are out for a paycheck. And I don't think that that is right because I am an outcast. And I don't know how many times I have told the teachers that. and they won't do anything. And I don't know what else to do about it because I've gone to the school.
Christy, I know there is a flip side to this, and I appreciate you raising that. I will say this. I think there are easier ways to get a paycheck than being a teacher in most school systems. There are easier ways. I mean, we don't pay teachers all that much to begin with. And, yes, I know there are some who are incompetent. That's why I support real testing and evaluation for teachers. But I'll tell you, most of the teachers I know are out on the front lines of a big battle, and frankly, I think they deserve combat pay. There is the other side. Christy, it's important to hear that, too. But when we get, excuse me, Rhonda, but when we get on to these issues of teachers and all the rest, we got to realize they really have huge expectations put on them. Now we're going to go to Christy. Calling from Louisville, listening on WFIA. Christy, you got the microphone. Go right ahead.
Hello, Dr. Mueller. First of all, I'd like to comment on your last caller saying that she thinks that teachers do it for the paycheck. Well, I am a teacher, and definitely I do not do it for the paycheck. With the level of education that you have to have nowadays, there are certainly other jobs, other professions that you would make a lot more money and deal with a lot less stress. I love teaching, but I tell you, it is very bittersweet, and it is because of the difficult parents that are out there. Just to share one of the stories with you, I could tell you many. I could talk to you for hours, but I had a parent not too long ago. Report cards were distributed, and the child had received a B in my class, and the parent had called and wanted me to explain. They didn't understand why the child, their child had the B in the class, and I simply, you know, I explained the grades that they received and the average and how it worked out, and that was the correct percentage, and they were just baffled. I mean, they could not believe. They said, something must be wrong. My child has never gotten anything less than an A. And then now he has your class, and this is his first B. What are you doing wrong? And they told me that something's not right. You must not be teaching right. He must not be challenged in your class. You are obviously doing something wrong because we can't understand, you know. And I don't even really know what answer I'd even given to them. So
Well, Christy, you're not alone in this. I get to teach at the graduate level, professor of systematic theology. I get all kinds of students. I teach at the college level as well, and the pattern just goes up. I mean, frankly, you get the same thing. We have wonderful students. I love all our students. Let me say that right up front. So there's no question. But several years ago, I had a student to whom I'd given a C on an essay. The student came up to me and said, "I am not a C person." And I said, well, whoever wrote this paper wrote a C paper, whether it's a C person or not. In other words, there is an objective evaluation. This didn't do what I assigned you to do, and certainly didn't do it well either. You know, when it comes down to it, one of the tough lessons of being in the educational process is the fact that our work will be evaluated. And inside ourselves, we really want it to be evaluated. We want to know how we're doing. And if we really are mature human beings, we want to do better. We're talking about chaos in the classroom and the war on teachers by parents. I'll be back to offer some distinctively Christian thoughts about how we should understand the role of teachers, the role of parents, and the reality of children. I'm Albert Mueller. It really comes down to parents first. According to the Bible, Christian parents have the absolute and direct non-delegatable responsibility to educate our own children. We are ultimately responsible. When we stand before God to be judged, we will give an answer for how our children were educated. And when we talk about education, that doesn't just mean, we know from a biblical perspective, that education does not just mean data poured into little human minds. It means the moral and worldview formation of human beings made in the image of God. That is a much larger issue. And parents have the first responsibility. But we do partner with others in this. Even if you are a homeschooler, there are other teachers in your child's life, whether you recognize it or not. Other teachers at school, other teachers at church, other teachers in different contexts. And we partner with these people. We need to support them. We need to choose wisely the educational options for our own children. As Christian parents, we need to evaluate where they need to be, where they need not to be. What kind of teaching environment, what kind of educational philosophy is consistent with our Christian worldview and would be consistent with our parenting philosophy. And with whomever we partner, we need to give support. To them we owe the respect of the teacher in the classroom. We also need to understand that our children are little sinners. Made in the image of God, yes, but sinners. I don't think I'd have many callers if I had to call parents to explain how they had to teach their children to disobey, to do wrong, to sin. They're little sinners. They need to be corrected. They need to be disciplined. It's true at home, and it's true when they're in other contexts, including school and church, as Mark reminded us. We need to back up those who are in authority. We need to teach our children to respect authority. We need to teach our children to respect education as a process that will require hard work, will require increasing discipline, will require blood, sweat, toil, and tears in order to receive the kind of education that really matters. At the foundation of all this, however, is the Christian responsibility to know that the formation of our own children as Christians, their own education in terms of Christian truth, is what is most fundamental. We can have little scholars who will grow up and just blow out the SATs and have perfect grades and go to Harvard, and they can be lost and go to hell. Our first concern is that they be confronted with Christian truth, with the gospel, with the transforming truth of God's word, and then that they be prepared and held accountable for whatever educational opportunities should later open to them. Time has opened a good conversation. I'm glad you joined me with it today. We'll be back next week for an intelligent Christian conversation about the things that really do matter. Today from Nashville, Tennessee. Tomorrow from who knows where, the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mueller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.